A cancer vaccine. You've probably heard of it. I've heard of it a couple of times, and there's not an it. There's usually multiple. Every time I delved in a little bit, I was like, oh, okay, I see what they're saying. Maybe it's for recurrence, or maybe if you know a protein. But today, I am very excited because I got to uncover or discover that there can be a vaccine for cancer. And I know that sounds wild, but I mean, even before you have cancer, potentially. And we're going to talk about that, how that works. I think you're going to find that the science makes a lot of sense. And there is none other to do it than Dr. Amit Kumar, who has a PhD in really something unrelated, electric chemistry, physics, fancy stuff. I spent a lot of time dedicated to things that help facilitate and foster care for everybody. He was actually on the board of directors for the American Cancer Society in the past as well, and now has founded this company called Anixa Biosciences. And what they do will blow your mind. How can you conceivably have a vaccine for a cancer when I've said a million times on my episode that the cancer cell is more or less your regular cell, but with neoplastic properties, right? I mean, that's the problem. How can you attack something that might be on other things? We're going to get into it. And for that, we couldn't be any more excited. I mean, it's very good to have you.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's very exciting to be on your podcast.
Great. So I'm just going to open it right up because I know there's other things that you are exploring that are in the pipeline, whatever you're comfortable sharing. But for you, the one that really kind of stuck out that you started with at your keynote speech at CAGLA, Cancer Advocacy Group of Louisiana, was breast cancer. And what got my attention was it wasn't, you know, we heard kind of within the last year about a vaccine for recurrences for certain breast cancers, if it expressed HER2, et cetera. But you unloaded the concept of vaccinating against breast cancer in general. And what you highlighted was that there are certain things, be them proteins or anything else, that you may not need to express at a certain point in your life, AKA, in this circumstance, pregnancy or breastfeeding. So imagine that something existed in a setting that was only required at a time you no longer require it. And that is why suddenly, immediately it clicked. I was like, that's so novel. I never thought about the fact that we have things that we don't need or needed at a certain time in our lives. So, how did you come up with that? And can you tell us more about it?
This is a technology that's been in development for over 20 years. Basically, we call it the retired tissue protein hypothesis. What that means, that's a mouthful, but what that means is that, as you noted, certain proteins are produced in certain organs at certain times in life when our body needs them. And in the case of breast cancer, there is a protein. In fact, taking a step back, as all of us know, when a woman gets pregnant, a lot of changes occur in her body. And one of the changes that occurs is that there's a protein, it's called alpha-lactalbumin. The name is not important for our context, for the context of our discussion here, but the point is that is a lactation protein. It allows lactation. As you know, women don't lactate all the time throughout their life, they only lactate after they've given birth to a child. And so when a woman is pregnant, the body tells certain cells in the breast to begin getting ready to lactate, to produce milk to feed the infant. And so that protein is produced at that time. And when the woman finishes, stops breastfeeding, the protein disappears again and is not seen again until she has another child. And then another child, and so forth. Eventually, after she is no longer going to have children or is at the stage where she can physiologically no longer have children, the protein is never produced again. Our bodies are very smart. They know, hey, we don't need this protein anymore, so we don't need to make it. But it was discovered that when cancer cells arise in the breast, those cancer cells are making that protein one more time. And so that becomes what we call an antigen or a target for vaccination. So basically, we call that a retired protein. It's needed during lactation, but it's no longer produced any time after that until cancer arises.
Sorry, that is insane. I mean, I gotta just to unpack that. It's a retired protein. It's like you had a purpose, you did your job, you know, your jersey goes up in the rafters in the Hall of Fame. Thank you so much. And you don't need it anymore. Like, you know, Michael Jordan kind of proved that when he tried to come back to the NBA, right? I hope nobody gets triggered when I say that. But your point being is that is something somehow someone decided to think of, and I assume it's you or your team, that this is something that is circulating that, wait, hold up, it should not be around anymore. And is that a protein that is expressed regardless of if, whether it's triple negative, hormone positive, or just HER2 positive and hormone negative, or is it just for the hormone positive?
No, we believe it's expressed in all types of breast cancer, but we have focused initially on triple negative breast cancer, which is the most lethal type. So that protein is clearly expressed in triple negative breast cancer and other types of breast cancer. So the hypothesis here is that if we vaccinate a woman after she's no longer going to have children, then the only time, and the vaccine will target that protein, the only time that protein is produced is when a cancer cell arises. And so if we vaccinated a woman properly and train the immune system to destroy any cell making that protein, the only cells through the rest of her life that are going to make that protein are cancer cells. And as soon as they arise, the immune system will destroy them. Just like if we vaccinate someone for polio or smallpox, as soon as that infectious agent is seen in the body, the immune system attacks it. And this is how we enable the immune system to attack cancer cells, by targeting that protein that initially was there, has retired, but comes back when cancer arises.
That is, yeah, I mean, you just want a second just to like let that kind of set in. So, wow. So you mentioned polio and some of these other vaccines. Polio may not be one of the ones where you need a booster, but you know, generally vaccines work. You have memory cells, the kind of surveyors that know what they're to look for, but then they start forgetting and then you have to re-remind them. Is it something that needs to be boosted in that capacity, or do you have pretty long durability? I mean, I guess you only as far as you know, because you have to create the vaccine to really know and have an amount of time to see if it disappears or not.
That's exactly right. Ultimately, it'll take time to verify that the vaccination effect lasts for a lifetime. But we do think it lasts for a lifetime. One of the reasons that many infectious disease vaccines need boosters is because many of them are retroviruses, meaning they're RNA viruses. They mutate a lot. And every season, you have a new version, new mutated version. That's why you need a flu shot every year, or you know, COVID boosters and things like that. But in this case, you're not targeting a viral protein that is mutating. You're targeting a self protein that is the same. It's produced by your own cells, in this case, cancer cells. But you know, it's produced by your own cells and it doesn't mutate. And so we believe that this is going to be a one and done.
So I need to make a point that this is not, some people hear, wait, so you vaccine against something and you kind of train the body. And I know this, and I just want people to understand this, that you are not engineering something. You're not, you know, fixing basically like a red blood cell, you know, sickle cell disease, that you are doing nothing that actually goes into the DNA. All you're doing is using or leveraging a very well understood and utilized technology. The technology itself, you know, we're familiar with, because a lot of people say, well, you don't know the long-term, you know, consequences of this and that. But the truth of the matter is there's nothing, you know, eerily black box novel. I can't say nothing, but at least it's a concept we've been using a long time. You just thought, well, instead of a virus, like you just said, let's do a protein of retirement or something that shouldn't be circulating. I guess now I got to ask the kind of weirder questions, which number one, and I don't think the incidence is very high, but, you know, some things that I teach my residents and fellows, especially when it comes to immune therapy, is people can have pituitary problems. And the thing we learned before oncology or immune therapy is, well, somebody can have a prolactinoma, right? And I'm sure the incidence is very low. So that's one circumstance where I'm wondering, it sounds like the worst thing that would happen is the cells that the prolactin is telling to lactate would just, you know, have an attack on it. And again, this is a very rare thing. The second thing, and I heard this from an attending, which I will not say his name, he was always a little weird, but brilliant. And he told me, well, he's like, yeah, Sanjay, you didn't know that if you do nipple stimulation every day to yourself, 10,000, you know, 100 times a day, like even men will lactate or postmenopausal, those two very odd circumstances, the latter being kind of maybe a runner that's the shirt is always, you know, rubbing. A lot of times when I ran forever ago, eons, you know, almost had to tape it because of the friction. Are those two things that you would think the response would happen, that you've already looked at, et cetera?
We haven't looked at that, but based on animal studies, what we would expect is that simply the immune system would, you know, destroy those cells. So there would be a little bit of inflammation where those cells were arising, but there would be no other physiological damage to the person. You'd just be, you know, and so the experiment that I'm referring to is an animal experiment where what we did was we took mice and vaccinated them. So trained their immune system to destroy any cell that's making that protein. And then we let the mice mate multiple times, actually. And each of the litters was perfectly normal. The pups were normal. The number of pups were normal. But the mother was not able to produce milk because the immune system had been vaccinated and trained to destroy cells making that protein. And all the cells that make that protein are the ones that enable lactation. And so what happened is the mother just couldn't make milk. Everything else was perfectly normal in the mother. Everything else was perfectly normal in the litter, in the pups, but no milk.
And I love that you mentioned that because I can tell you're a true science man, because one might think, well, why do you have to do that? You know, it's called lactin and obviously it shouldn't affect pregnancy. You obviously understood the humility of medicine. That thing is called lactin or whatever the derivative of lact is because we think it's only there, right? Like that's the humility of medicine. So you wanted to ensure that there was another pathways where something we thought was exclusive to lactation was also incidentally relevant to the actual delivery process. And that's really reassuring that you're able to appreciate that in that circumstance. And that makes perfect sense. They're just going to lactate.
Yeah.
With that said, you don't just have animal models, right? You have well put this into human beings and have some preliminary data. I don't know if you can share it. I don't know if you can say that, but this is not a lab only thing right now.
That's correct. About a little over 2 years ago, we began testing it in human beings, and so far we have tested it in over 25 women, and we find that all of these women are having an immune response. We do find that some women are having a stronger immune response than other women. We're not sure why that is. Maybe it has to do with genetic factors. Maybe it has to do with number of times that particular woman has lactated, meaning how many times she's had, how many children she's had, and so forth. But eventually, when we have a larger population you know, for whom we've tested this vaccine, we'll have a little bit better ability to make those correlations. But remember what happens with cancer. So stepping back for a second, in the case where we showed that we could destroy all of the lactating cells in female mice that had litters, basically what we're showing is that this vaccine is able to induce the immune system of that mammal, of that individual mouse, to destroy billions and billions of cells, you know, all of, you know, because that's how many cells are produced when that mouse is lactating. Now, cancer, as you know, arises out of one or two, a small number of aberrant cells that, you know, becomes two cells and four and eight, 16 and so forth, and eventually becomes a multi-billion cell mass that you can see in a CAT scan or a mammogram or something like that. But we think a very modest immune response is able to destroy those cells at the earliest stage, at the six, you know, at the eight cell stage, the 16 cell stage, and so forth. So if we feel that we can destroy, the immune system can destroy billions of cells in a lactating mouse, we haven't tested it on a real lactating human being, but we believe that we can destroy handfuls of cancer cells as they arise, even if there's a very, very modest immune response for these women.
And I mean, that's key. We've said it so many times in this episode that, you know, when you see the tumor is just when you see the tumor on a CT scan, right? Like, I mean, it takes millions and millions of cells to appreciate it to a few millimeters on a CT scan.
That's right.
And many say we're beating quote unquote cancer. Now it's a matter of semantics, but we're beating it, you know, unknowingly because it never festered, because immune cells, you know, or even the intracellular cells realize that there was damage being done or something aberrant and taken care of. It's the ones that escape the initial kind of surveillance that then are basically permitted to multiply to an extent to be able to be seen. But I'm sure some people are thinking and probably like, well, Sanjay, please ask him this. I hope you ask him this. You said it can destroy billions of cells, right, on what mice that are lactating. Then my next question is, have you given it to somebody with cancer already, like a triple negative?
We have not yet, but we will be in the phase 2 study. We'll be giving it to patients who have some minimal residual disease. But we have given it to, again, you know, in animals, you can do a lot of studies, but we have given it to animals that have had breast cancer. And we do see that it significantly shrinks those tumors. And we anticipate that this vaccine potentially could even be used in a neoadjuvant setting for patients who have already been diagnosed with cancer. So there are a lot of options here. The key point is that we've discovered a way to enable the immune system to destroy cancer cells. Now, we want to destroy those cancer cells at the earliest stage so the patient never has cancer, never has to go through surgery and additional chemotherapy, you know, the brutal process of treating breast cancer. But if a person does get breast cancer, we also believe that this vaccine could be utilized to help that patient destroy or reduce the size of that tumor so that subsequent treatment is going to be less brutal.
Yeah. And then even on the adjuvant side, like you said, you know, with the higher risk, the stage threes, or if you did a neoadjuvant, then took it out and you still saw, you know, tumor there, that's when we often, you know, recommend chemo or immune therapy or whatever.
Yeah.
I could see it as an adjunct to say, also, you know, try this for potentially during the chemo or the treatments, or, you know, if somebody's not fit enough, then give it your best shot with that. So there's just so many ways, you know, one can think of it quite easily, depending on your goal. And to my point about the cancer, I will say, and we talk about this too, I've talked about it a few times, is when you have high volume cancer, or, you know, a lot of it, you start to see this tumor evolution, like heterogeneity. So where I practiced up in Shreveport, sometimes we would have some very neglected cancers, you know, I mean, one, I was able to see the clavicle, like it was just eating up the breast cancer. And so we biopsied, and I still remember being a bushy-tailed, you know, first-year fellow. I'm like, well, why does it say poorly differentiated here and carcinoma of unknown primary versus, you know, adeno here? And they're like, it evolved so much. Like it was adeno at the breast, and then as it came to the surface, it really lost a lot of its features because it was unregulated. So to that point, you know, a high volume would be a little more theoretically challenging because it could have just dropped this lactin thin because it's whatever that lactate protein or, you know, it's called. So yeah, so that makes sense on why kind of the lower disease amounts. But to your overall philosophy, you know, we know chemo causes cancer or has a risk of cancer, you know, down the line, 5 to 7 years with, you know, with alkylators and the, we always get tested on the board. If you could spare someone all of that, that would be just huge. So it's very kind of timely on mentioning that you have an expression of something that kind of suggests a neoplastic process, because again, it shouldn't be there. We actually just released our episode this week with Jeffrey Venstrom, the CMO of Grail of Galleri. And we talked about it about halfway through about, yeah, I could tell you have cancer, but I was like, Jeff, when are we gonna be able to recognize things that even before it becomes cancer? Like, you know, some things leak, for lack of a better word, some things that look a little shady, but aren't quite invasive, you know, carcinoma. I wonder if this is something that, if not already, is seen on these more kind of novel, innovative, futuristic, you know, circulating tumor DNA things. But it's not DNA, though. It's a protein. But if whatever is coding that protein potentially may be a tip-off that there is a, you know, a lactin-producing something into that constellation of 300, 400 things that they're looking at as it is.
Yeah, eventually, you know, we think that certain of these retired proteins could be used as biomarkers. But, you know, with the vision for this breast cancer vaccine, as well as other vaccines that we're contemplating for other types of cancer, we believe that we can destroy, the immune system is a better detector than us taking a blood sample and looking for the protein or DNA indicating the protein. And so we believe that we can, the immune system will detect those cancer cells, destroy them, you know, early on, so that none of that protein or a very little bit of that protein ends up in the system. And so we don't think that, you know, we will have a need for looking at that as those proteins as a as specific biomarkers for detection. Grail is a whole different different type of animal. They're trying to do a multi-cancer detection test,
right?
Which is designed to look for DNA indicators of tumors of various types in one blood sample. We're hoping that when Grail does its test, that they'll never see any indicators of breast cancer, because hopefully we'll have vaccinated that patient and she'll never have breast cancer.
Right. Yeah, that's the point, is that if they have access to this, then you wouldn't even care about the circulating tumor DNA to code it or the protein itself, which is absolutely mind-blowing. So with that said, I'm not going to let you get by without a comment you very casually made, which was, and considering looking at other things. So you have identified, and you don't have to share them, you don't have to say yes or no, but there are, one would assume that there are potentially, I guess, other retired proteins or the same kind of concept or philosophy of recognizing something that just shouldn't be around. Or I'll take it a step further. What if you were able to just, you know, isolate a gallbladder or appendix specific protein, right? Those are two cancers I, you know, fear, if I'm having to have, you know, forced to say, what do you fear? Like two of those, because they're just so, you just don't know about them until they're a problem. Like, okay. You know, no symptoms, kind of like anywhere in the pancreas and lung cancer and stuff. And I'm like, well, a lot of people actually had their gallbladders and appendix out. That's two cancers you have to worry less about that are pretty nasty. But anyway, I was curious if there are things like that that are either one, retired, or two, not even retired, but not necessarily necessary, to where if there is a, you know, significant percentage of people where the risks outweigh the, where the benefit outweighs the risk, it may be even worth considering giving, because the consequences of a cancer from that place would be so bad.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you referred to cancers that, you know, show up that you don't even know about until it's way too late. One of those is ovarian cancer, often diagnosed at stage 3 or 4. Initial presentation is at, you know, very advanced stage. And so we do have another vaccine that we're working on to target ovarian cancer. We've identified another retired protein. It's a protein that helps in maturation of the eggs, and only exists on the ovaries, only on that tissue. It disappears over time gradually until a woman reaches menopause. And by then, it's gone at any immunological level, meaning there may be a little bit there, but it's not immunological. So at that point, and by the way, most women get ovarian cancer. Most women who get ovarian cancer are postmenopausal, although there are some that are pre. If we can vaccinate women when they hit menopause and prevent epithelial ovarian cancer from arising, because that protein shows up in epithelial ovarian cancer again. And same concept, it's a retired protein, exists on the ovaries at a certain, you know, certain periods of life. At menopause, it's not necessary anymore, so it's no longer produced by those cells. But postmenopause, if epithelial ovarian cancer, which is the most common form of ovarian cancer, arises, those cells are producing that protein. So again, we want to train their immune system to recognize those cells and destroy those cells before they can become an ovarian tumor. And as you know, ovarian cancer, debulking and in fact, just today, I'm speculating here, but we're hearing that Princess Kate has cancer, and they haven't specified what type, but it might be ovarian cancer. And it tends to be at a very late stage and often very difficult to treat. Very poor quality of life for the people who are being treated, and often fatal.
Yeah, I mean, that's It's a very fear, including my wife herself. It's just, she does predominantly gyn oncology, and she's just, it's a hard pill to swallow just because there's no real screening modalities or anything. Now, somebody might be listening and saying, well, that's all great, but why don't I just get my ovaries out? But here's the catch that I assume that maybe you can validate, is you said it's on the lining and helps the maturation of the eggs. So the vaccine would actually still permit you to have, you know, the, some of the positives of having some hormone production and not going straight into a surgical menopause, right? To where, you know, that cutoff of hot flashes and everything else. This is one way that actually preserves some of the benefits, either quality of life or otherwise, with having your ovaries, even in a postmenopausal state, versus somebody taking them out and just having being cut off, you know, other than what's kind of peripherally circulating, but that's still usually problematic for even postmenopausal women. So that was number one. And number two, I'm hoping, my second question, I mean, is does this also get expressed? I hope so. Please say yes. You know, with that smaller percentage that is still considered and treated like ovarian, but kind of, you know, is circuits the fallopian tubes and that kind of lining. Is it produced in all those places?
Yes, it is. In fact, you know, ovarian cancer is often, it's sort of a misnomer. You know, ovarian cancer can also be, tumors on adjacent tissues. But yeah, so we believe that we can prevent a lot of those types of cancers. And, you know, getting back to your first question, which is some women like to, you know, choose to just have their ovaries removed. And frankly, we know in today's world that we have some good genetic tests to determine if women carry certain mutations, not only that place them at high risk for ovarian cancer, but also breast cancer. And many women are having prophylactic surgeries to remove their breasts and ovaries. I mean, Angelina Jolie, you know, comes to mind as someone who went public with her journey a few years ago. And yeah, people do that and reduce the risk. But why would you go through that, you know, very, very invasive procedure if our data eventually shows that taking a couple of shots could prevent those cancers from ever arising? So, you know, ultimately, it's all going to be driven by data. We have early data on the breast cancer. The ovarian cancer product is still in the animal testing stage right now. But some years from now, we will have data, enough data on enough women to show that we can prevent these cancers. And if that's the case, why would anyone even opt to have those very invasive and painful surgeries, right?
Yeah. And so this phase one, with the 25 patients you had, did you identify those with a higher risk of triple negative, like a BRCA1, BRCA2, personal history, or was it just, what was the criteria?
So in the phase one, we started initially with focused on women who actually had already gone through triple negative breast cancer treatment. So they've gone through their neoadjuvant treatment, their surgeries, post-surgical adjuvant treatment, and you know, whatever the treatment was indicated. And we know that a large percentage of these women, over 42% of these women, will recur within 5 years. And so initially, even though the vision for this breast cancer vaccine is eventually to be able to give it to all women who've never had breast cancer to prevent onset of breast cancer, the initial testing is being done on women who have a high risk of recurrence of breast cancer, so that we want to prevent that recurrence. Because if we can show, and a part of this is a practical consideration, Sanjay, if we started testing this on women who had never had breast cancer, the time for that clinical...
The data would take forever. Yeah, we'd all be losing the benefit. Yeah, exactly. Because you have to wait for years at a high enough volume. Yeah.
Yeah. So now we're trying to, we're sort of, the way to look at it is, we've got an enriched population. So in the case of women who have gone through triple negative breast cancer treatment, we know that 42% of them will recur within 5 years. And so in that case, we can do a study with about 800 patients, 600, 800 patients. Half of them will get the vaccine. The other half will get standard of care. And what we want to see, we know that the standard of care group will have 42% of them recur. So if you have 400 of those patients, 42% of them is, what is that, 300 and some patients that will have a recurrence. What we want to show is that the 400 women that get the vaccine, hopefully none of them will recur, or a much smaller number of them will recur relative to the group in the 42%, the group in the standard of care arm. And then we'll expand that to test in women who have never had breast cancer. And that study will take a little longer. I shouldn't say a little longer. It may take multiple years longer. But meanwhile, this breast cancer vaccine will have been approved and be available for women who are worried about recurrence. And it can also be used off-label for women who've never had breast cancer before.
Yeah. And in respect to, our listeners that have stage triple negative breast cancer or a loved one, it is a challenging disease course. I don't want anyone to hear and be like, I have 42% chance. There's a lot of modern therapies and things that hopefully account for a more generous side of that statistic. But you're saying that your point being is that it is what it is with standard of care. I would love for it to be less than what the best available management is today. And to that same point, do y'all have any trials open in a is this an available therapy in any capacity currently, or are we just waiting to see what happens with the phase one?
It's too early for it to be available to the broader population.
Mm-hmm.
The only women who are getting it right now are the ones who are participating in the trial, which is a small number, but we will be beginning a phase two, and our anticipated beginning time for that is sometime in Q1 of this coming year. So,
oh, wow.
In 2025.
Yeah.
And we anticipate multiple sites throughout the country and some sites in Europe as well. And so it'll be a larger number of women, but still somewhat small relative to the general population of people concerned about triple negative breast cancer. But again, it's a manageable size trial that'll enable us to take it to the FDA and other international regulatory authorities to get this approved and then available for patients.
Amazing. Well, we're talking about that kind of retired status and then also recurrence risk. A very obvious question. I'm sure a lot of my listeners have been waiting because they're all mostly smarter than me. They're like, Sanjay, why don't you go to ask about prostate cancer and PSA, right? We have this biochemical recurrence that we just watch like a hawk and the guidelines keep changing what to do about it, or at least have changed more recently. Anything on that with the PSA? I mean, you want it to be zero. Is there a way we can keep it zero with a vaccine?
Well, absolutely. We are now looking at identifying retired proteins in other types of cancer. So we've got one candidate in breast cancer, and that's already in human testing. We've got one in ovarian cancer, and that's in preclinical testing. And now we're beginning the discovery process for similar retired proteins for the other big cancers, big incidence cancers, which are colon, lung, and prostate. You've referred to other types like pancreatic and so forth. And eventually we'll get there. And the other thing I want to point out, though, Sanjay, taking a step back for a second, for the last several decades, researchers have been looking for proteins on cancer cells that are overexpressed. What's the difference between a cancer cell and a regular healthy cell? And as you know, there's small differences. The cancer cell arises out of your own healthy cells. But some of the differences include proteins that are overexpressed, which are primarily things like HER2, other growth factors, right? In breast cancer, HER2.
EGFR, and, yeah.
Exactly, EGFR. And so those proteins have become the targets of therapeutics to try and destroy those cancer cells. And we've had numerous successes there. People have tried to develop vaccines by targeting those specific proteins as well. The problem that causes is huge autoimmunity issues, because what happens is if you create a vaccine that targets an overexpressed protein, sure, that vaccine is going to induce the immune system to try and destroy those cancer cells. But the vaccine is also going to induce the immune system to try and destroy other healthy cells on which that protein is expressed, albeit at a lower level, but it's still there. And so you create basically autoimmunity against a whole bunch of other organs and tissues. And so that's really not a process that will work. But that's what's been tried in the past. And that's why we think cancer vaccines have not worked.
It's a step further than just at a lower level, because where immune system works at times is if you're getting sensitized. So like all of a sudden you can just start really growing your response. It's a point of like a quicker recovery with COVID. It's not, you know, you never had it.
Yeah.
Bro, like it's not, the vaccine doesn't put a bubble around you. You just got to get it and recover it quicker because you propagate. And so it's kind of an example of my wife and I kind of debate on where we move the dial when one of our kids are too irascible and cranky, you know, and you know, haven't slept enough. I'm like, the more discipline actually just makes them worse, and we're going to go to bed later because you got to give. And it's the same concept with the immune system. Sometimes like the more exposure, the more you try, it actually propagates. And that's why you can have these lingering problems with immune therapy, for example, where you have it for several weeks and months because it lingers. It's just like, oh, that was, you know, we caught a wave and now you have more surfers come. And that concept is an important one. And anyone listening, just I want to give a clinical context to you. It's the same way why we use some TKIs or tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And we're always saying, like, you're going to get skin stuff. You're just going to get skin stuff. Because, like, some of the EGFR has skin stuff. And then when we have with colorectal, you know, this one's going to cause a rash on your face and you need minocycline. And then the other ones are going to cause diarrhea. That's your exact point, is that when you're attacking something that's elsewhere, how do you get it in a sanctuary? And you can't. And that's why yours is so unique. You have identified something that is not elsewhere, you know, in that context or setting.
Yeah. And so you know, getting back to the original question that you asked about other cancers, you know, we're looking at ovarian and breast right now, and we're going to start doing some discovery work on some other cancers. But as this initial breast cancer vaccine moves through clinical trials and demonstrates its success in larger numbers of women, the whole landscape of cancer research is going to change, because now all the researchers are going to start looking for these retired proteins, proteins that were there but are no longer there but arise again on cancer, because now they can be the antigens not only for therapeutics but also for vaccines. And you know, we always talk about the cure for cancer, and you know, referring back to the breast cancer situation, our medical system, people like you, brilliant oncologists like you, have become very good at keeping women alive who have had breast cancer. So we keep more women alive today than we did 20 or 30 years ago, right? But the process of keeping them alive is brutal. The surgery, the neoadjuvant, and the, you know, post, you know, adjuvant therapy, then the worry about recurrence, you know, those are all, you know, real things. And people who've had cancer, who've had a family member that has gone through breast cancer, you know, can relate to this. It would be great if we could just give people a few shots and they don't have to worry about any of that. We want to put you out of business, Sanjay.
that was the title of my email. I said, you know, I introduced you to the production team and some others, and I said, we have a podcast guest and he might, you know, put us all out of a job, because we're all like cancer, you know, mediated, which, believe me, I would take that in a second if it meant the suffering and the debility of cancer goes away in a second. It's just very emotionally challenging. So one of the things that I'm thinking about in the same concept, so it might not be a retired protein, but there are unique proteins that aren't really expressed in general, I don't believe, in the human body at all. And I'm specifically talking about ones, I could be wrong, but on the hematologic, like malignant hematology, right? So these are situations why when you talk about CAR T therapy and we get excited about it, it's a concept somewhat at least akin to yours, but far more expensive in my opinion. Like, you pull out these antibodies and lymphocytes out of the, you know, the person, and then you engineer them to see that the protein. So it wasn't a vaccine. Like, you're like, yo, I'm going to give you that beforehand and you're just going to circulate. These we take away, stamp it on its forehead, put it back inside the body, and then it goes and finds that thing and goes in rapid fire kill. The problem with that is one of them is, it sounds like I'm doing a pitch for you and anyone listening, like, this is just a friendly relationship that I just met you, you know, like speaking, and I was excited about it. But problem with that is something called cytokine storm, CRS, where like the reason for that is it goes so rapidly, amazing, like killing everything, that all of the calamity and flare signals of injury, that's why you get admitted and kind of get washed for weeks, right? Because you can get into a very, very advanced septic-like picture with fevers and dropping blood pressure. That is a fundamental difference because you have high volume, relatively speaking, disease attacking something that is unique to that cancer versus yours being like, the whole fundamental principle of a vaccine is at, you know, patient zero or one when they talked about COVID and all that, who was N equals one, you know, same thing. When that cancer cell is that the equivalent of the one or two is to be able to hopefully find and address that so that you don't have these storm-like pictures. With all that said, is that a mission for someone else as far as the thought of vaccine for these hematologic diseases? And by the way, if you're listening and you're an entrepreneur and it is, then you got to give, you know, loop me in because that's some credit there. But or is that something you're investigating already?
No. You were referring specifically to RT type of therapy, where in B cell hematological diseases, you can.
There's unique receptors and sometimes,
yeah, there's a unique protein, CD19, that's found on B cells and no other cell in the body. And so in that case, you create engineered T cells targeting those B cells. And you get this cytokine release syndrome because you have engineered these T cells to be super powerful, essentially B cell killers. They kill the healthy B cells as well as the disease B cells. And then they release all sorts of cytokines that induce other aspects of the immune system. But, you know, we've learned how to manage those aspects. The problem with that CD19 protein and the reason it couldn't be a vaccine target is because it exists on B cells all the time, right? If you vaccinated someone against CD19, then you would immediately destroy that person's B cells even before they had cancer.
B cells are needed for the actual immunity. So you're actually
B cells are needed for a certain type of immunity, for the humoral immunity. And so what you really want is a target that only exists on cancer cells when they arise and doesn't exist at the time you vaccinate someone. And that's why we like these retired proteins. They only, when you vaccinate, in the case of women, you vaccinate a woman after she's no longer going to have children so that no healthy cell will ever produce that protein.
For sure. And I might be probably showing a little bit of my ignorance here, but, you know, with paroxysmal nocturnal hemagglutinuria, the PNH, the C55, 59, or there are these random ones we're checking, but if I'm thinking off the top of my head, we're actually checking a ratio. So they probably still exist in some normal capacity.
Yeah,
because I don't think they're just like, you know, yeah. So maybe that's what I was thinking, was the ones where we're checking specific markers, but it's more so a ratio percentage to say, yeah, you have PNH or, you know, plasma cell.
But you bring up a really good point, though, which is, one of the other targets that people are thinking about these days are what are called neoantigens. Exactly. Neoantigen is essentially a normal protein that has been mutated in cancer. And so it's a little bit different than the normal protein. And so the question has been, could we target that neoantigen as either a therapeutic target or a vaccine target? And people have tried both, but only in a therapeutic setting. The reason is because in a mutated protein, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of mutations, they're different neoantigens, and so all of those vaccines tend to be personalized vaccines, meaning you take a tissue sample from the patient, you sequence that patient's tumor, and identify the neoantigens that could exist and which might be immunogenic, meaning which might be recognizable by the immune system, and then you create an mRNA vaccine, because you can do that very, very quickly, and use that to try and target that,
that colony that's exhibiting that.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that was the comment. That was also the sentiment I was trying to share with the Grail Gallery comment too. It's like, that tells you at this time, based on what we know, but ideally there is a test where that's a neoantigen-based test where you can get a heads up. So if you're not comfortable with that 3 or 5 year, you know, interval as a clinician for the colonoscopy, right? That's a long time to wait. I mean, you just don't know. Then you can get a test that ideally it's not to say, yeah, you have colorectal cancer, which still that will help because you're getting a scope earlier and hopefully catching it as the stage one. But if I could get it and be like, oh, look, there are, you know, the proteins or neoantigens that come from a tubulovillous adenoma, which we know is high risk for cancer, and that would be a good, you know, kind of insurance approved, everything is that reason to say, oh no, yeah, you're good, go ahead, because we don't want to take the cost of, you know, stage 4 cancer. It's sad reality, but the truth that everything really depends on what makes sense. Unfortunately, to like financially in that circumstance, it's like, yes, get your scope earlier because we don't want this to be a bad thing.
Yeah.
That's probably why it's pretty neat about yours, because I can't imagine, you know, to share, but I'm just thinking out loud. I mean, compared to CAR T and the labor of pulling and the engineering and all this stuff, you know, the vaccine concept is again, not a new one, but that's just my thought. So super interesting stuff. Is there anything else you would like to share? Just assuming, just pretend our audience, because we are just nerdy people that get really excited about things that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And as they relate to cancer, anything else, you know, related or unrelated that you'd like to share with us, or something you're excited about, or anything?
I mean, I've been in the biotech industry for 3 decades. You can tell, you know, by my lack of hair, you know, you still got a good head of hair there. But this is the most exciting project that I've ever worked on. And I think it's going to change the paradigm of cancer and how we think about cancer, how we think about preventing cancer. And you know, breast is the first step, but there are many, many, you know as I know you've had interviews with Sid Mukherjee and others, there, you know, cancer has been around since we've been around, and it would be wonderful if we could do for cancer what we have done for infectious diseases. You know, some of those infections, you know, smallpox and various other diseases have been, I think I heard a statistic that said smallpox has killed more people than any other disease throughout the history of mankind. But we've eliminated it effectively now, right? You know, imagine if we could do that for breast cancer and a few other types of cancers. It would just change everything. It would be amazing.
Yeah. I dare say I know measles, but I thought smallpox also had a little eruption a year or two ago. But then, so would breast cancer if the vaccine worked.
Yeah.
You know, same concept. And one thing I'm thinking out loud, probably wouldn't matter, but when you donate blood, obviously you get antibodies or IVIG. You'd almost have to mark that donor to, you know, if they're donating and they have the vaccine, there'd be need to be some caution if you're giving it. But then it depends if it's IgM or IgG. So if you didn't have the vaccine, you know, within a couple of months, the IgG could be filtered out, et cetera.
Yeah, it shouldn't be an issue. You know, people who are vaccinated for all sorts of things donate blood.
But if you give it to a 21-year-old, the blood?
If you give the vaccine, we're not giving the antigen, right? You know, the blood does not contain alpha-lactalbumin. And so...
Right, but it carries the antibody. So like if the person recipient is a premenopausal, a pre-childbearing age or childbearing age. I mean, just doesn't mean thinking out loud. I don't know.
It'll be a little tiny amount, you know, at best, a tiny amount of the antibody, because the antibody, you know, as you know, the way the immune system works is it's primed. And so it has memory. And so when the agent that a particular T cell, for example, is targeted towards shows up, then those T cells start expanding. That specific population of T cells goes after that target. So, for example, you know, when you've been vaccinated against smallpox, you know, we have T cells in our bodies that will target antigens related to smallpox, but it's a very tiny amount. But if smallpox shows up, then those T cells expand. They start, you know, multiplying and then destroying those cells. So it's really... It shouldn't be an issue for blood donation.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being here. And again, that can find, it sounds like, look for early quarter 2025. Hopefully, this being expanded and anything that anyone can do to help explore this, if deemed safe, they'll be able to find you. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.